Philosophers in
Space, 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 space.
That is the sound of inevitability.
Logic clearly dictates that the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few.
Behind.
What about the reality where Hitler cured cancer, Morty? The answer is don't think about it.
Love is the 21 gigawatts!
Hello and welcome to episode 5 of Philosophers in Space. How's it going, Aaron?
Oh man, we get to find out the exciting conclusions of whether artificial intelligence has personhood. I'm so excited.
Any robots nearby? Got any robots around?
I'm checking my room for robots.
Yeah.
I'm talking into a robot.
This episode will feature The Twilight Zone, Season 1, Episode 7, The Lonely, in which, yes, they refer to robots as robots, which I love. I don't know. I guess there's no reason one's any more right or wrong, but robots.
Robots. And we're going to we're gonna use that to talk about the second part of the sort of what I consider the opening arguments, if it were, of the artificial intelligence personhood debate, which is we did the Turing test last time. So today we're going to talk about the Chinese Room and the problems it raises for functionalism.
Yeah, really, really interesting stuff. I can't wait. Truth be told, The Lonely doesn't have much, if anything, to do with the Chinese Room, but let's face it, it's just a fun chance to talk about robots. And I love this episode of The Twilight Zone because it's ridiculous, but it's also such a peek into like how people thought about these things, you know, popularly in 1959. You know, so it's so different and so interesting.
Yeah, I agree. I do think there is some substantial connections here. I think the story of the character and how he interacts with the robot sort of plays to the questions of what it will be like for us to experience entities that are effectively Chinese rooms.
Okay. All right. Yeah, that's true. All right. Maybe I sold it a little short. But in any case, we better get over to, it's our first time of doing the exposition for the actual Twilight Zone.
Ooh.
You're traveling through another dimension beyond that which is known to podcasters. It is the middle ground between fair use and copyright infringement, between ordinary fanboying and meaningful analysis. It is the exposition zone.
So this is an absolutely absurd premise, and it is the most cost inefficient way of keeping. It's like, okay, so the premise of this episode of The Twilight Zone is that there's a man who is a convicted murderer who is being kept on an asteroid millions and millions of miles away from Earth. So it's like, you know, I don't know if you know this, but when I worked for the state, I worked in budgets for the state prisons.
Mm-hmm.
So we already have just what is considered an incredible, you know, amount of money we spend. You know, you see that figure that's like it costs $60,000. And sometimes it's more depending on the kind of inmate, but you know, $60,000-$90,000 a year to imprison a person, you know, in California.
Right.
That's totally true. Like it's that much. This would be on the order of billions and billions and billions of dollars to keep a convict on an asteroid. It's the most absurd. I don't know why they thought of this, but anyway.
This appears to be their main form of punishment now because there's like these criminals are spread out across the asteroid belt and they're constantly being serviced by these resource ships.
Right.
It's super weird. Maybe they don't have a lot of criminals in the future. And so they're like, they can do small batch artisanal torture. I don't know.
But anyway, he's on an asteroid, which mysteriously has the exact same gravity coefficient as Earth and has a full atmosphere. Yeah, that's always that's always fun. But But if you ignore the absurdity of that premise, what you have is, a brilliant Rod Serling bit of writing about the experience of him being lonely. It's a very lonely guy up here. Well, it's called The Lonely. That's the name of the episode. And he has a whole car that he's put together. That was I like it because it's sort of, a useful artistic kind of comparison there. At first, he has a car that they brought him to amuse himself with. So he put together, he assembled an entire car in like a year. So that's what he's done with some of his time. And again, the cost of taking an entire car out to outer space. I guess it was before really any sort of advanced space program, right? I guess we had like rockets and stuff, but before we realized, okay, every pound is precious that we would try to get anywhere in space.
Right. I think it's like $100,000 at least per pound or something to put something into space.
They've dumped so much money into this one convict. He's like the most expensive man ever. Well, who knows? Maybe there's another convict out on a further away asteroid.
I like that it has a lot of sort of absurdist theater elements to it.
Hmm.
The car sitting there being useless in this vast landscape. It's very nice symbolism for absurdities that go along with this isolationist way of suffering.
Yeah.
It just reminds me of things like Artaud and that sort of stuff.
Right. So he's so lonely that the supply ship captain kind of takes, has sympathy for him. And that guy brings him, the captain on the next visit, brings him something, a gift to kind of keep him company. And it turns out this if we haven't dumped enough precious, resources, technology, money on this one convict that we could just keep in a room on planet Earth. But anyway, if we haven't wasted enough on him, he has now brought him a functioning, fully human-like robot that is just a woman who, but this is every episode of The Twilight Zone, if you've watched it, robot person just means it's a person. Like there's no costuming. There's no nothing. It's just this person is a robot. And they've left him a fully functional, human-like, lifelike woman companion to keep him company.
Yeah. He initially freaks out and says that she's not real, even though I like the description about how she has he describes everything like a memory Rolodex, basically, and being programmed to express human emotions and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And at first he's like, you don't actually feel these things. It's not real. Like, stop torturing me with your fake impersonations of emotions. And then he comes around to it and starts identifying and believing and thinking that this is a real person. And we get a couple of jumps in time where we see them sort of developing a relationship and becoming deeply attached.
Yeah, it doesn't go too much in depth. It's kind of it's a short episode and there's not that much development of their relationship, which I wish there would have been. But also, okay, so what's crucial, I think, is the ending. And I'm very curious to see what you thought about this, because it kind of leaves it up to interpretation a little bit. So the main character could we go so far as to say he's kind of fallen in love with a robot?
Totally.
Yeah. So he seems to be, significantly involved emotionally with the robot. And then wouldn't you know it, the crew comes back, the supply ship crew, and they say, finally, they've changed the laws. We've run out of money. Like, the entire planet has run out of the resources. No, they don't say that. They say, oh, look, you got a pardon, and they're getting rid of the whole one person on an asteroid program.
Space liberals have taken over and they've reformed the social justice system.
Yeah. And so they're like, okay, well, let's hop on the ship. We got to go. By the way, we have a very tight window because of the orbit of the asteroid. So
bounce around to all the time.
Apparently. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, but I mean, that part's at least accurate, though. Like, you have to be in the right, part of the orbit to be able to do these things. But the part that's funny is that it's always like conveniently 15 minutes. 15 minutes away from being totally in the wrong place. But anyway. So they've got to go. And he says, okay, but we've already picked up a couple other of the most expensive people in the universe. So we don't have very much room. We've got room for you plus 5 pounds of your stuff.
You're right.
And I think what's funny, actually, this is, I guess it's a minor thing, but maybe it's worth noting. At first, the main character, the convict, we didn't do any names, but his name is James Corey. So at first, James Corey just assumes that the captain is referring to both him and the robot. Like, he's like, okay, you've got room for us, plus, you know, whatever. And it's actually kind of important because he says, get the things, like gather your things, gather any things that you have. And he says, well, I don't have any things. I just have like a notebook. That's all I need. At a certain point, he realizes that the captain is saying he has to leave the robot there. You know, that he's not, when he says gather your things, the captain was counting the robot as a thing. And he wasn't, in his mind, it wasn't a thing. It was a person. And he had just taken for granted that both he and the woman robot would be on the ship. But no, they can't. They don't have enough room. They don't have enough weight. They don't have enough fuel to carry all that weight.
Yeah, that's the exact moment, I think, that it becomes clear that he's not, he doesn't see this individual as an as-if kind of individual, but actually sees it as a real person, because he's not even thinking of her as being in the category of things.
So here's the part that I found so interesting back when I watched this like 5 years ago, and I just thought it was so fascinating, because what happens is the captain is like, dude, we gotta go. We got 15 minutes or we're stuck here for years. And this is a thing. It's not a person. You know, he's nowhere. He hasn't fallen in love with the robot. He's nowhere near thinking it's a person. So he's like, we got it. So he pulls out his gun and he just shoots the woman robot in the face. And I'm really curious to see what you think, because it seems as though we don't really get much dialogue after that or answers, but it seems as though that breaks the spell. It seems as though for the convict, he's kind of like, oh, wow. He kind of snaps out of it. Like, gosh, I guess I was, because we get a shot of some really, you know, 50s makeup, but it's the girl's face is now, you know, it's the inside of her is, you know, nuts and bolts. It's metal. It's that kind of thing. And that seeing that breaks the spell, I think, if I'm interpreting it correctly, or maybe it's up to interpretation. And I found that so fascinating, because think about the alternative. The alternative is, if you shoot a real person in the face and you see bone and blood and brains, then you're like, oh, that was a person. You know, like, why would that be? Why would we think that if you see some tissue that, you know, is looks like brains and blood and bone and that kind of thing, you have, you would be horrified. You'd be like, you just shot a person. But if you shoot a robot and you see metal, then you're like, oh, never mind, it was fine. And it shows the substrate chauvinism, which is why I thought of this episode. Like, it is hardcore substrate chauvinism, to the point where a person potentially is murdered, and because the inside of the person turns out to be metal, you're like, oh, it doesn't matter.
I agree. I think you can definitely view it that way. And from that perspective, it comes across as very inhuman and very cruel to take that relationship away from the individual. I think it's also, though, an accurate portrayal of how human psychology might work in these sorts of situations.
I agree.
Where in isolation, he really could get so attached that he forgets that it is not an artificial entity. And then he, when confronted with that reality, it could, in a sense, break the spell of that treating as real experience.
Right. But so think about, like, imagine, I mean, maybe this is, imagine it's like 2000 years ago, though, and pretend for some reason we live in a very, you know, just an incredibly peaceful part of 2000 years ago. I mean, without TV and, you know, gory crime dramas and stuff telling you what it looks like when a person gets shot in the face, for all we know, this is could be what it looks like when a person, you know, like, I think it's so odd that so much of this is dependent on, okay, what is behind the person? Like, what is inside the person's head? When realistically, if you live a good life, you should never have to see a person's brain. Like that would be something you could actually avoid in life. And I just think that's so interesting. Like, that would be the thing. And I think it is accurate. I think it probably is accurate, especially from the point of view of the captain, who's like, look, I just dropped off a box. He never really you know, encountered the robot much. He's like, I dropped off a box and, you know, now we got to go. So I'm just shooting this thing. But right. It's so funny that if you hopefully, Aaron, when you and I interact in real life, hopefully I won't ever see your brain. That would be or you won't ever see my brain. Like it's going to
I know. I have one of those like floating outside of my head brain kind of things like a Brainiac. It's,
all right. Bad example. Cool. Let me talk about somebody else because you're it's okay, true. I forgot enough, about that. But in all our interpersonal relationships, that should never come up, hopefully, you know, unless something goes terribly amiss. I don't have to see the inside of someone's brain. Like we just treat people how they are based on our interactions. You know, it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, amongst the body parts of mine that you're never going to see in our personal interactions, the brain will be one of them. And that's good. I don't show
the brain till the third date.
No, exactly. No. Right. So I do think that it's good because while it seems cruel, much the same way in Next Gen, Maddox seems very cruel in his way of viewing data. I think it's useful because it is the kind of cold water in the face approach that we see with the thought experiment that we're going to look at today. And I think it's valuable to see that kind of pushback against the feeling of, well, you know, if it is as if, you know, if it really feels like the real thing, is it really not the real thing in some kind of way? And, and is the fact that there's something fundamentally different happening in the underlying system at all important to how we should treat these entities?
Yeah. So. And I just wonder how much, just to tie this up, and then we should really transition over to the thought experiment. But I just wonder how, I wish I could kind of get in the minds of the writers of this in 1959, because as you were pointing out before we started recording, that's like what, 9 years after computing of any kind, or what were you saying?
Well, this is 9 years after Turing and about 30 years after the first mention of the idea of the robot back in Rossum's Universal Robot.
Right. So, but it's so interesting because for me, based on how, you know, I've grown up and how what I've seen in popular media and all this stuff, for me, it's like, I wouldn't think that. If I'm presented with a robot that is a person, like, I'm pretty partial to just treating it as a person, especially if we're stipulating that it's passing the Turing test and really acting like a person. I'm very partial to just like, okay, that's a person. But I wonder to what extent these writers were thinking, yeah, this is just an illusion. And once you shoot it in the face, it's just an illusion that's broken. And you're just like, oh, what was I thinking? You know, I wonder, I'm not sure.
I get the impression at the end that there's a little bit of nuance to that last line. And like his delivery isn't perfect, but I think what they're trying to go for there is, even though the spell is broken, the feelings remain, and he has to endeavor to walk himself out of the attachment that he had to this entity.
Yeah.
You asked, before we started recording, you were asking about the new Blade Runner movie, and there is a sequence in there that is very similar, feels very similar to this scene, but is much more effectively done in a movie.
I haven't watched it yet.
I'm not going to spoil anything. But like in a movie that I didn't really totally enjoy for the most part, it was one sequence that I actually thought was well done. And it does raise interesting questions about the legitimacy of these relationships, which is, I think, something we're going to continue to explore in future episodes as well.
Very interesting. But for now, we need to strap on our thought experiment machine. Is it something you strap on? Probably. There's straps.
I always envision it as more of like a lever that you pull.
Okay. Well, I think we could do both. We could do like you put on a helmet, has a strap, and then you pull a lever and then bam. How about that?
Yeah, I think we should definitely get some Doc giant hats. I'm for that. And then I would like the lever because I want to be able to shout.
Do you put your hat on your head or on your external brain? It would have to be on your external brain, huh?
Yeah, no, it would be an external brain hat. Yeah.
Well, let's do
obviously.
It.
Initiating thought experiment. Engage.
All right, tell us about the Chinese room.
Okay, so the Chinese room is a thought experiment response to the Turing test that tries to sort of make very clear that something could pass the Turing test without being the same kind of mental processing machine that human beings are, and that it follows that certain claims within computational theory of mind, which is the idea that mental processes are the results of things like symbol manipulation, formal symbol manipulation, that kind of formal symbol manipulation isn't sufficient to create the kind of consciousness that we are aware of. It doesn't appear to be sufficient at present. So here's how the experiment works.
And this is Searle, right?
Yeah, this is Searle. So it's like the Turing test in the sense that you're going to engage in a language game with the entity. Only this time the entity is a human being put inside of a room. They are given a bunch of books that are filled with English explanations for how to translate certain Chinese symbols into other Chinese symbols. So if you're given this list of symbols, you replace it with this other list of symbols.
Right.
Okay. And then what happens is individuals outside of the room who can't see what's going on inside feed Chinese sentences that actually make sense into the room. The individual inside of the room then translates those sentences without knowing what they are saying or anything, just merely moves the symbols around as the rules tell them to, puts the correct response back out of the room. And then the question is, do we really believe that this entity understands Chinese in the same way that an actual Chinese-speaking individual understands Chinese?
Just to polish that up a bit. So it's not as though they're translating, though, right? Because it's almost like you're just seeing an if this, then this. Right,
right,
like
exactly.
You're seeing one Chinese symbol, you've got or a series of them, you've got a bunch of instructions that they don't tell you anything about what it means. They just tell you, okay, if you see this, then output this other Chinese symbol, just to clarify.
Exactly, right. And I think he likes the idea of it being Chinese symbols because they are characters that the English speaker wouldn't recognize.
Yeah.
And so there's no way to impart any sort of meaning from them the way we might if it's like a different language but is the same alphabet.
Right. So the key question seems to be, does that person understand Chinese? And Searle thinks like, obviously not.
Right. Exactly. So the idea is they clearly pass the Turing test for Chinese, right? They speak as if a natural language Chinese speaker would speak, but they do not have what it is in terms of experience that a true Chinese speaker has, which is the semantic content that goes along with the syntactic symbol manipulation. So by semantic content, I mean the mental states and things that arise when I read the word tree. Mm. I don't just see the letters tree. I also imagine trees from my life. I associate it with stories about trees and metaphors about trees. And so if you talk about the giving tree, I know both, you know, what that metaphor is, but also the book it's referring to, all of this kind of additional associative content that real language speakers naturally experience when they are hearing things in their own natural language.
Right.
And this room appears to have none of that. All it is formal symbol manipulation. And therefore, it doesn't appear to be a consciousness, and it wouldn't make sense to treat it like one.
Right. So should we talk about, I mean, there's a lot here to talk about, but should we talk about the most popular reply that Dennett is partial to that makes sense to me, which is the system reply, which is...
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not as though the person who's merely following these instructions necessarily, you wouldn't say that person understands Chinese, but you'd say the entire system understands Chinese. So like, and the way I think of it is like, it's not as though, you know, the part of your brain that controls how your mouth makes sounds necessarily under, you know, like you could think of it in those terms, like your mouth doesn't understand English, or maybe even parts of your brain don't understand English, like the parts that control the muscles that move your mouth and your tongue or whatever, those don't understand English, but the whole system of your brain and the parts and the physiology, all of it together, we say that person, that whole system understands English.
Yeah, exactly. That is what we would think of as the sort of functionalist reply. I've talked a little bit before about like if an entity like data, for example, acts like us in every kind of way, then it makes sense to treat it as something like us. And it might make sense to say that even if it doesn't necessarily have some of the same capacities to express experiences the way we do, that its full system might still be processing the information in the same way that we are processing it. But I don't think that's a good argument. I think it doesn't, it's just false. It seems like whether you're talking about the human being in the room or you're talking about the human being plus the books plus the room itself, combining all of those things together, there's still no locus of personal experience that is the same kind of personal experience that an actual natural language speaker is having.
Interesting.
I don't think that the system response works. And I think it has some pretty weird reductio ad absurdums that come along with it. That, like, if Dennett's arguments are true, then we have to start talking about things like the stomach and the liver as process, as, like, you know, conscious processing subsystems. We have to start talking about hurricanes as information processors. We have to start saying that thermostats have consciousness in the same way that human beings have consciousness.
Well, that's interesting. Can you dig into that more? Why that would necessarily be a result of this?
Yeah, because Dennett's view is that all of us are fundamentally these information processing systems, and that there is no function, there's no substantial distinction between a less complex information processing system like a thermostat and a more complex information processing system like a human being. That we're just on the same spectrum of consciousness.
Yeah, but it is a spectrum of consciousness. I mean, it's not, that doesn't strike me as that devastating a response, but maybe I'm misunderstanding something. I mean, if you say, because like, if I say, okay, an ant's brain and a human brain are obviously vastly different, like human brains are vastly bigger and more complicated and can do more stuff and all that. But they're on a continuum. And so you could say that there's something that it is to be an ant. And it's not like it's that absurd, right? Is it? That doesn't seem absurd.
Yeah, I wouldn't use the ant comparison because the ant does appear to be on the evolutionary spectrum, which for us gives us reason to think that it would be somewhere on the spectrum of consciousness because it seems like a lot of organic entities are on the spectrum of consciousness. But the reason this is problematic is something like, if it comes time to take apart a house, do we have to feel like we are killing a thermostat when we pull it apart?
Well, no, but that's just my point. Just as when we kill a few brain cells by a night of binge drinking, we don't think, okay, we're killing a thing. That's what I don't get, because what I was going to go on to say was, I think an ant's brain is still vastly more complicated than a thermostat.
Right.
You know, like, so I guess I kind of get it, but why would that necessarily be absurd? Like, just because we can, you know, because in we've had conversations on here about mereology and, you know, at what point a small thing becomes a bigger thing. And it doesn't seem that absurd to say, you know, yeah, I mean, they're on something that could be considered the same spectrum, but they're so far apart that we don't have to be worried about the thermostat being conscious.
Right. The problem comes when we then attempt to try to draw the line between the entities that we actually do need to treat morally and the entities that we don't. Right. It's fine to say, oh, well, we're not actually going to treat the thermostat that way. But if we've really said that fundamentally there's no difference, then there's no way to easily draw the distinction between the artificial entities that we should give rights to and treat as conscious entities and my laptop. Like, it's not clear on that view why my laptop shouldn't have rights of some sort, or shouldn't at least be given basic protections as a processing
entity.
Well,
maybe we shouldn't talk about rights necessarily, because there's a lot more that goes into that, right? Like perception of, you know, your laptop doesn't feel pain and doesn't, you know, there's a lot of stuff that goes into that.
We don't know that on the functionalist view. You can't make those kind
of
assumptions.
Yeah,
I mean, like, that's the problem. Like, so Dennett's system is good because it allows us to talk about consciousness without understanding the hard problem of consciousness. It doesn't solve the problem of how the entity that we think of as conscious is different from the entity that has an as-if kind of consciousness. And therefore, you can't say this entity that appears to act like it feels pain doesn't actually feel pain.
But I think my problem with this is that it doesn't, I know it shouldn't be a requirement that you have a better idea. You know, like, it's fine to just poke holes in ideas. That's totally fine. However, uh-huh. I can't help but think that the only other possible idea about this is magic. Like, if it's not, you know, like, if it's not this, then it's magic. Like, there's some magic soul human thing that makes, sure. you know, like, what does he,
yeah.
does he give you any other explanation for what actually gives us understanding or experience in the way that he's talking about humans having?
He doesn't try to, like, provide a solution to the hard problem of consciousness. He doesn't try to say this is where consciousness actually necessarily arises from. He merely is trying to point out that it's not clear, based on what we understand so far about the nature of symbol manipulation, that a system that can that does pure symbol manipulation should really be viewed as being the same kind of conscious entity as a human being. And I think it's a reasonable pushback. I think he's right to say that when I plug some words into Google Translator, that it is not doing the same thing as a human being who is a conscious translator.
Well, that's true. Yeah, no, that's true.
And there's a whole world of content that we experience that a symbol manipulating.
But we have, okay, but that's where I wasn't sure if I was going to save this for After Dark, but mm-hmm. I do remember, you know, I've read a lot of Dennett books where he has talked about this, and I think that the Chinese Room thought experiment is actually completely impossible. And mm-hmm. I think that it might matter, you know, like, because we do a lot of hypotheticals, and I don't know that it always matters if this is technically ever possible, but mm-hmm. with this one, I actually think it might matter, because imagine, and Dennett does a good job of illustrating this. It's been a few years, but I think he talks about, like, he talks about an example where, what if what's fed into the Chinese Room is symbols, Chinese symbols that make the like a visual representation of Tiananmen Square. And mm-hmm. imagine the amount of knowledge that would have to go into those instructions that would tell you, that would somehow tell a machine, or rather a person in the machine, what, how many steps you would need to get from some symbols that are not, by the way, it's not what they actually, the symbols actually say. They are arranged in a visual formation that shows Tiananmen Square that any Chinese speaker would know. Like, any Chinese speaker would recognize. Mm-hmm. Imagine mm-hmm. what would go into that. And I actually think if you really broke it down and you attempted to really make a try at thinking about what would go into this, the amount of instructions you would need to pass the Turing test. Because remember, we're not talking about Google Translate. We are sure. not talking about merely translating symbols. We're talking about passing the Turing test in another language without understanding it. The amount that would go into that, I think, is bigger than the universe. Like, it actually is not possible. And he right. makes a compelling argument that's more numerical. That's what gives you more measures that I don't have at my fingertips here. But I think that might be relevant. You know, it might be relevant that this couldn't really happen. Like, to say that it could pass the Turing test, never being able to do any of that, to actually understand what's happening, to say that that's impossible might lead you to believe that if we ever encounter or were able to make an AI that could do this, that could understand Chinese or any language, that what they're doing isn't this, you know, like, that what it would be doing is not necessarily just some basic instructional symbol manipulation thing.
I think that's right. And I think Cyril, I think, would agree that this kind of challenge to a symbol manipulation system, he wouldn't say that this doesn't, you know, this proves that we can't ever make a robot that does natural a robot, excuse me,
robot
natural language capacities. His view is just that for it to, sort of like what you're saying, for it to be a conscious entity in the way that we really think of it, it would have to go beyond the mere symbol manipulation in some sort of way. And what that means, you're right, is very hard to pin down. Like, would, you know, if the system generated a bunch of associative images the way that I was describing my brain does,
right,
and generates those in a way where it then processes those associative images. But then the question becomes, what would the module be within that system that processes those images, and how is it How is it reacting to them? And is it reacting to them in a way that is still just reducible down to a set of very complex symbol, you know, manipulation of ones and zeros? Or does it really, is there a sense in which that entity at some point could see the tree in their head and think tree the way that we do? And then maybe you could push back the other way, like Dennett does, and say, we're a little overzealous in what we think is actually happening in our own heads, that we don't actually process this information. That was the qualia stuff that I teased a little bit last time, that like what's going on in our heads isn't actually as robust as we think it is either.
Right.
So they kind of, they meet in the middle that way by inflating what the entity could do and deflating what we do.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's really, I think you are asking very good questions here. I don't think that these are unimportant questions, and I think that they are reasonable responses as we're trying to work through this. And I also think that what we said in the last episode still holds for entities that you don't know the nature of its system. You should be doing like you're saying and giving the benefit of the doubt that it is
right.
a conscious
entity.
Right,
if it's acting like a just as we do with animals, or at least
exactly,
at least ethical people do. You know, they don't treat animals as though they can't feel anything.
Yeah, and he actually, Cyril discusses this, and he actually goes through a lot of really good objections in this paper, which I recommend people read through if they get a chance. The other mind's objection, this is the Yale response, he says, is the idea that, you know, you treat me like I'm a conscious entity, even though you've never seen inside of my mind and known that there is actual cognitive things going on in there. And he pushes back and says, you know, that there is a real difference between you and me. Two entities that grew up via the same evolutionary track that have all the same physical substrates and exhibit very similar kinds of behavior, and an entity that was constructed via a very different system. And, you know, if we know what the kind of modules are inside of its mind, we can know fairly conclusively the limits of its capacities in a way that I can't know the limits of your capacities.
Absolutely. Well, I've just noticed that We are plumb out of time, but this is such a good topic that we could talk about forever. I think we'll just have to continue the discussion on Philosophers After Dark. What do you think?
I think so, too. And I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, me too. So thanks so much for joining us again on Philosophers in Space. It's been a pleasure. This is a real fun one. There's so much here.
Yeah. Let's not forget to plug our next week.
Ooh, yeah. Give us a little preview for the next episode, Aaron.
For our next episode, we're going to break out our first movie review. Mm. We are going to talk about Arrival, which is by the same guy who just did the new Blade Runner movie. Villeneuve, I believe is how it's pronounced. And it is about aliens and philosophy of language and communicating with alternate entities. So we wanted to, you know, break off from the AI for a little bit. We're certainly going to come back to it, but we wanted to get into a couple of different new topics. And I know we've got some philosophy of language nerds out there listening in. So I'm going to own up for the beginning. I am not a philosophy of language expert, and I will probably get some things wrong, but we're going to try to make it fun and interesting.
But you're in luck because I am a weird octopus alien expert. So
awesome. Great.
Yeah. I know everything there is to know about him. So
I don't understand why you didn't bring that up when we were like spitballing shows, because I feel like we could have done an octopus alien show.
Normally I lead with that for every conversation. Weird.
Should be at the top of your resume.
Yeah. That's going to be a lot of fun. So catch that movie if you get a chance before the next episode so you can follow along. Hey, also, we just want to note that if you join us over on patreon.com/zeroG, we are going to likely be putting up a poll for future episodes. So you get a chance to vote on what sci-fi or possibly what philosophy you want to see in future episodes. So that's another reason to join up over on the Patreon.
Yeah. And if you're a patron, then you're clearly having fun and you want to come join us over on the Facebook group, which we link in our show notes, because
that's free too. You can just join the Facebook group. There's no, you just have to answer a few simple questions to make sure you're not,
make sure you're not a robot.
Yeah.
We can't have any robots coming in and symbol manipulating all up in our group. It's not cool. But yeah, come join. We've got a bunch of philosophers and everybody's having fun. And
it's really cool. It is well worthwhile. Definitely. But we'll have to leave it there. Thanks so much for listening.
That's all for the main show. But if you'd like to go to patreon.com/zeroG, you can enjoy Philosophers in Space After Dark. Here's a little sneak peek for you.
How the hell did we evolve to do this? It's just so crazy.
That's because aliens did it for us.
Yeah, it must be. But where'd they come from, though?
Stargates.
Oh, okay. Where did those come from?
The aliens, obviously.
Yeah. It's just aliens all the way down.
It's aliens. Oh, yes. Thank you. Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm glad that I didn't have to pull that one out for us.
Yeah.
This has been a burst transmission of Philosophers in Space. All music written and performed by Thomas Smith. If you've enjoyed your infotainment upload, please locate the nearest podcast interface device and fill it with 5-star ratings and glowing reviews. If you think Ground Control should spring for fun new goodies and content, consider supporting us at patreon.com/zeroG. You can find us on Twitter at zeroG Philosophy, where Aaron will instantly and compulsively respond. Or you can email us at philosophersinspace@gmail.com. Finally, if you're sad that it takes so long for our signals to reach Earth, you can always find Thomas over at Serious Inquiries Only and Opening Arguments, and Aaron over at Embrace the Void. Until next time, live long and philosopher.